I'll let Frank take it over on the state of the art.
So I'm going to talk about state of the art for ontology repositories. Some people make very fine-grained distinctions between repositories and registries. I will treat them as synonyms here. Okay, and I'm at the National Science Foundation. However, as you can see on the next slide, none of my remarks have anything to do with the National Science Foundation. If they find out about me, they'll disown me. Okay. I'm going to address some of the key design issues in building an ontology repository and some of the implementation alternatives and the technologies being used to address these issues. But it occurred to me I was giving the first talk of the day, so I'm going to say a little bit about what I consider an ontology repository here, why you want one, some of the macro versus micro issues, which I'll explain in a minute, and then I get on to more detailed implementation issues. And the implementation issues will include a discussion of, well, how do you get these, how do you acquire these ontologies, how do you ingest them, again, these micro versus macro issues, centralized versus decentralized or federated, issues of ontology representation, in which I will talk about several alternatives, but not UML. Sorry. And I'll talk a little bit about the kinds of search and query capabilities that people want. I'll have one slide on ontology integration. I'll say a little bit about some of the auxiliary tools that people want in these systems. And I'll talk a little bit about service-oriented architectures and where they fit in here. Okay, so for the purposes of this talk, and probably for the conference, an ontology repository is a system for storing, searching, retrieving multiple ontologies. And they typically have support for ontology integration, which I'll talk to more, and they may or may not have various other tools for ontology creation, editing, visualization, annotation, and curation. Okay, so what differentiates an ontology repository from, say, just ordinary tooling for ontologies? And the answer is we're trying to deal with multiple ontologies. And so this poses problems of scale, probably the easier problem to deal with. It poses problems of diverse ontology representations, of which I'll say more. It poses issues of how you do integration across these ontologies, because typically, if you've got more than one, the reason you've got them is you want to extract portions from several of these things and combine them. And it generates some complex provenance issues, of which I'll say a little more later. So why would you want an ontology repository? The answer is you need to deal with multiple ontologies. And the usual reason for wanting to have ontologies, you're doing natural language processing support, data integration, data exchange. You want to specify the semantics of your database more, or your data exchange system more precisely. You want high-level support for helping people form database queries. You want to do database or application design. You want to do classification and indexing of documents, so the traditional library sorts of applications and online versions of this. Or you want to build, you want to create, maintain, and facilitate the use of controlled vocabularies, for various reasons, but usually because you want to make the data content to be more standardized so you can, more comparable. Okay. And I think most of the people in the room have some sense as to why they want to do this. So the first question is, well, how do you get these ontologies? So one way is, You make up a list of the ontologies you want, and you manually load these things in, or you do it with the assistance of some tools. But the point is the identification of which ontologies you want is done manually, essentially. And an example of this is the XMDR system being developed at Lawrence Berkeley Lab. And Bruce Bargmeier, the PI, is sitting right here. So that's one way to do that. And why would you want to do it? Well, if the ontology representations are very diverse, you may have to do some custom loading, and you may not just want to get random ontologies. If you're more ambitious, you can try spidering the web to find these ontologies. So you could use a system like Nutch or any one of the other spiderings, and you run around the web, and you find things that look like ontologies, and you scoop them up and copy them into your repository. Or if you're building a decentralized one, you just put a link to it. And the other possibility is you can use Google to search for ontologies. Look for files that end in .owl or have these things. So the question, of course, is, well, how do you recognize an ontology? So if you're a human, you can usually tell whether you've got an ontology most of the time. But typically the way you would recognize this is you see lots of OWL or RDF or common logic. You see lots of ISA and part of relationships. Or maybe someone's thoughtfully put a comment in the thing that says, this is an ontology. So why do I mention this? I mention this because there are things like FOAF.RDF files floating around, which might be mistaken for an ontology, but that's actually instance data. And you don't want to scoop up all the FOAF.RDF files, friends of a friend, RDF files into your ontology database, because you won't find any very interesting relationships typically in terms of class relationships there, and there are growing numbers of these things. So you need some way to recognize this, and it's not a trivial problem unless the people writing the ontologies are helping you. Okay, so then you have the problem of ingesting these things. So you may do some parse. Typically you can tell by the end of the file name, it'll end in .owl or .rdf or something like this. Or you can try scanning the file and recognizing the language. And then you can try parsing this ontology and doing some syntactic validation to make sure that at least it makes some sense. But beyond this, you may want to do more elaborate kinds of consistency checking. So, for example, a theme I'll return to several times, taxonomies and partonomies are partial orders, which is to say they're directed acyclic graphs. These are the most common kinds of ontologies, I think, in the world today. And if this is what you think you're looking at, you'd like to check that there aren't any cycles in this. And then the question arises, do you convert this to a common representation? And different systems have taken different approaches to this. I'll say more about this as I talk about ontology representation. But some people just stash, again, XMDR, are just stashing these ontologies away as text files and not trying to convert to a common representation. But there are other systems, ODM, the Ontology Data Definition Metamodel from OMG, which Elise Kendall has worked on here, tries to map everything into UML. Various other people have tried to map everything into variously either RDF or OWL or Common Logic. And again, if you're going from, let's say, the older KIF version to Common Logic, then you've got some minor syntactic cleaning up to do. But sometimes you have more serious semantic translations and going from one representation to another. And you also have issues of closed world assumptions versus open world assumptions. And I will say a little bit more about this when I get to ontology representation. And then beyond that, you have the question of if you're ingesting this, let's say you're putting it into a RDF triple store or something like this. The question then becomes, well, what indices am I going to build into these ontologies? And am I going to attempt to do transitive closure computations on these partial orders, of which I will say more later in the presentation? Okay, so centralized versus federated architectures. I would say most of the systems in the world today are centralized, which is they collect all the ontologies into one place. These systems have fairly high startup and maintenance costs, but they can give you fairly fast retrieval, and it facilitates integration because you've got all the pieces there. So you can do curation, annotation, other sorts of things which are probably more difficult in a federated architecture. A federated architecture, the ontologies stay put. So, for example, you could envision something like a LDAP server, which would go off and search through ontologies. Or you could have a list of sites which you send queries off to and things like this. Relatively low startup and maintenance costs, typically less performance and less reliability. And furthermore, depending on what version of this you do, you may impose more requirements on the sites. So, for example, if you're building a Sparkle query interface to this thing in the really most radical federated architecture, this means that each of the sites you're talking to needs to support a Sparkle, some sort of Sparkle interface. The alternative is a hybrid in which you centralize the ontology level metadata and indices so that you can do what I'm calling macro level queries across the collection of ontologies fairly quickly. And then once you identify the ontology you want, you could either talk to it directly or you could go just grab that one ontology and ingest it. The idea here is that you're typically leaving the individual ontologies in place at least most of the time. So macro versus micro level. So recall that I said that an ontology repository deals with multiple ontologies. So at the macro level, we're running queries or browsing or whatever across the entire collection of ontologies, usually to find which one we want. Either we want, if we're doing environmental stuff, maybe we want to see the suite ontologies out of NASA. If we're doing medical stuff, we may want to look at UMLS, or we may want to look at SNOMED. But we want to find the relevant ontologies first, and then typically we'll want to probe in more detail what I call a micro level. We'll want to search within an ontology for a particular concept or concepts that we need for whatever it is we're doing. Now, the problem with this distinction is that you're sort of forced into doing this, but many times what you want are these individual concepts, and what you really like to do is search across all of these ontologies for these concepts. So the line between macro-level facilities and micro-level facilities, particularly in searching, sometimes gets blurred. But most of these systems today, I think, are these two-level architectures. And the point that I'd like to make here is that the macro-level representation and search capabilities and the micro-level capabilities, most of the issues involved here are essentially the same, and you can use the same either keyword search capabilities or the same semantic search capabilities at both levels. In fact, unless you're a masochist, you probably would not want to choose a different representation at the macro level from the micro level. But sometimes people do this, in particular systems which tend to scoop up ontologies automatically may have a more simplistic representation at the collection level. So what does this mean? What this means is that at the macro level, at the collection of ontologies level, you probably want an ontology of ontologies. And so in particular, you probably want some sort of taxonomy over the subject matters. And you may need some sort of ontology of the ontology metadata. But other people will talk about that later in the conference, I believe, so I'm not going to go into this much more detail. People want to search either across these ontologies or within an ontology, and there are two basic approaches to doing search. One is text-based search. People want to do this on the natural language definitions that underpin the they may occur at multiple levels of the ontology, but you certainly have to have typically some natural language definitions for the concepts that are not defined in terms of other concepts. So atom or something, well, atom in high energy physics may be decomposed, but let's say you get down to the level of quark. Quarks are not defined in terms of anything smaller these days, and so you'd have to have a natural language definition. You may search across the symbols in the ontologies, and as an example, people use Lucene, one of the popular text search engines, or they use UEMA, this text search, framework from IBM. And the other alternative is you can do semantic search. Here you search over the ontology representation, which may be RDF or OWL or Common Logic. I'll say more about all this later. So, for example, people are using Sparkle. People are using faceted, so a query language interface. People are using doing faceted search if you have a faceted representation of the ontology. And people are providing navigational sorts of search capabilities across taxonomies and things like this, typically in the settings of graph-based formalisms. So I'm going to talk about four ontology representations, but not UML. Because this is partly in the interest of time, partly because I'm less familiar with UML and I consider it odd. But people are doing that. Anyway. But I would say most people at the present time are either using text, frames, graphs, or logics. So, text representation. So this is the simplest representation. You just scoop up this file, you store it on your server, and you maybe index it with keyword indexing and other sorts of things. This is a great way to deal with the natural language definitions. More common representation, perhaps, in systems that are being used for controlled vocabularies and things like this. It's a lowest common denominator representation for more formal ontology representations. And it readily, so the attraction of this is that if you're going out and you're scooping up ontologies with 5 or 10 or 15 different knowledge representation languages or formats, putting it into a text representation or perhaps encoding in XML or something like this is a simple way of coping with these things, at least initially. However, directly it only supports text search. Now, I say directly because what is done in some systems, I think in XMDR, is they put a tag on the text file, and then if you want to do the micro-level search within an ontology, they'll ingest that particular text file with an appropriate inference engine. But let me come to frame representations. I had thought that frame representations were long dead, but Mark Musin here informs me that this is not true, that they are alive and well and being used in the biology community in the OBO format. A frame representation is a collection of frames. Each frame is a collection of slot value pairs or possibly a slots and value lists. This technology was originally deployed in Lisp, dates back into what, the early 70s, I believe. What? 60s. And the people are, once your ontology gets bigger than will fit in main memory, you have to figure out how to store this on disk, and there are two basic approaches to this. One approach is to store each frame as a blob, a binary large object. And so as you walk through the ontology, you load individual frames in. The hope is you won't touch all the frames in the ontology. The other alternative is you can decompose the frame into finer-grained database entries and use a object-oriented or relational database where a slot value pair becomes every slot name will perhaps be a relation and the value will be you'll have a well, there are various ways of doing this, but you could have a entity, you could have a the slot could be an attribute name and then the value would be the value in that field. I'm not going to say a lot more. I will say two things. One of the things you can do with frame representations is you can map them into graph representations. So graph representations go by very many names. The most popular these days is RDF. There's also RDF schemas, which add a little more complexity to this. And some people are building graphs with xlinks, which is part of the XML standards, and you may say, why would you do this if you had perfectly good RDF standards? And the answer is, well, some people are trying to do this, and in particular, it's heavily used in the XBRL standard. And so I assume most of you are familiar with RDF. We have RDF file is a list of edges. Each edge has a subject, a predicate, which is a relation name or attribute name, and an object or attribute value. Any of these things are URLs or URIs, so you can stretch this thing across the entire internet. It's a very flexible approach. However, it only supports binary relations directly. If you have an entity relation, you create a blank node typically, and then you have edges pointing to the edges labeled with the individual attributes, and they point to separate nodes, so that you map a single entity relationship into n binary relationships, essentially. So then we get into types of graphs. And this is a subject near and dear to my heart because I'm interested in graph databases and I'm interested in the use of graph classifications and knowledge about the structure of the graph to assist query processing. So the simplest kinds of graphs are essentially trees. So think Dewey Decimal System or Library of Congress or something like this. Typically, these are ISA relationships. They may be part of relationships. They may be narrower and broader term relationships. And you have one root, and you have usually the edges going up, indicating like an ISA relationship or something. These are the simplest ones, but life is somewhat more complex than this. First of all, you'll have multiple trees typically because or interleaved trees with different types of edges, because you're dealing with both taxonomies and partonomies in most cases. The next step up are multifaceted classifications. These are, as I said, taxonomies with multiple facets. So, for example, vehicles, you may have a purpose, either freight or passenger vehicles. You may have a propulsion system. It can be internal combustion, external combustion, diesel, something like this. You could have the number of wheels as an attribute for which you're doing a facet here for classification, and the number of axles and the color. Multifaceted classification systems were introduced by, who's this guy from India? Ranganathan.
Ranganathan.
What? Ranganathan. And they've become quite popular. They're used extensively in catalogs. They were used, I believe, in SNOMED originally. They tend to work best in relatively homogeneous collections of objects. As the objects become more diverse, making sense of these multiple facets becomes harder and harder. And Barry Smith, who's not here today, among others, is a proponent of using these in contrast to multiple inheritance, which is a less structured mechanism, because he thinks you get yourself into trouble with the multiple inheritance. And then the next step up from multifaceted classifications are directed acyclic graphs. As I said, typically these are used to support the things above here. They can also be used to support multiple inheritance. And a directed acyclic graph is essentially the same thing as a partial order. And there's an elaborate theory for this, and I'll say more about this later. Then there are arbitrary directed graphs, i.e. they may have cycles in them. So as we add more semantic relations, for example, in UMLS has cycles in it. Certainly once you start adding synonymy edges and things like this, you can introduce cycles. And then we come to named graphs. So named graphs have essentially a separate inclusion hierarchy typically. You can have names on subgraphs essentially, and edges can point to or from these subgraphs. Why would you want to do this? The answer is if you want to have comments about collections of edges, such as provenance, such as credibility, such as various other sorts of things. Name graphs are recently become popular. There is now a tech report, I believe, from W3C on them, and we'll say more when I get to implementation. So partial orders. Many ontologies are partial orders. That is to say, they're directed acyclic graphs. And common examples are taxonomies and partonomies. If you're doing ontology integration, I'll come back to this, and you're building mappings between the two ontologies, say from concepts in one to concepts in another, these mappings, you want them to preserve the order relationships. And I'll come back to this again, but if you want to see more material on this, look at the work by Cliff Jocelyn, who's now at, was at Los Alamos, now at PNNL. Minor notes. RDF isn't really a graph. It's a collection of edges, and it doesn't allow naked nodes, whereas traditional graph theory, you can have naked nodes. Oh, so the question is, if you're going to use a graph implementation, how am I doing on time, Steve? Okay, I can finish in 20 minutes. So there are a variety of ways of representing graphs. Some slide got deleted. Okay. Triple stores. Oh, I know what I wanted to refer to. Remember I said that our RDF was a collection of edges, and each edge has subject, predicate, and object, that is, a from node, a to node, and a relation between them? Well, you can store these are things that are, if you just store a list of these triples, that's referred to as a triple store. Usually there's some additional indexing that goes along with this on query capabilities. In point of fact, most people are not building triple stores these days. They're building quad stores, or even more exotic things like quint stores, and I think someone's building an octo store. So they have more. The point is you get one long, skinny relation out of these things. You can store these things either in a specialized standalone system, you can store them in a relational database management system, or you can store them in these more specialized relational database systems called column stores, such as Vertica. So quad stores and named graphs, you add this fourth element to the relation of all the edges, namely the name graph that includes this edge. And so this lets you support name graphs. It lets you do other interesting things. The subjects and objects are no longer just nodes. They can be subgraphs because you can make the – you can't see my finger. Do we have a pointer? No. Okay. So you can make the object here be a reference to one of these named graphs. And this is a very powerful thing. It's also being deployed, if you're familiar with the reification capabilities in RDF, you can sort of dodge that in some cases and use this to support reification, and it's allegedly faster. So the secondary storage of these graphs are typically in the form of these long, skinny relations, either triples or quads. In some cases, people are putting these into relational databases. For example, IBM, I know, is working on this. I believe that Oracle is using a relational store, essentially. The column stores slice things by individual attributes, so a quad store would have four columns. Examples of this are MonetDB and Vertica. Typically, you will actually build multiple indices. So if you have a triple store, you'll do six different indices on pairs of these attributes. And there is another approach in which you build clusters of edges rather than a long, skinny relation. You do sort of clumps of these things. And the leading proponent of that, I believe, is still Cogito, which is a small company in Salt Lake City or just outside of Salt Lake City. So then the question is, well, how do you query these things? And right now the leading approach to doing this is Sparkle, and it's undergoing W3C standardization. I'm not a great fan of Sparkle. One of the attractions of graph systems is that you can build various kinds of complex pattern matching queries, either in Sparkle or in other languages. And this is easier to express in some cases than it is in, let's say, logic-based queries. So I would say today the two main representation approaches are either these graph approaches, which have the advantage They have the advantage, right now I think the scalability of these things is in better shape than the logic-based representations. So the logic-based representations fall into, I guess, three main categories and various other ones. There are description logics, such as OWLDL. These have had their expressiveness restricted to make them decidable and hopefully computationally tractable. This statement is not quite true. Sometimes these things lack cardinality constraints. They almost always lack arithmetic. There's data log, which is the Horn logic approach. Data log is primarily used in the database community. In fact, it's a fair bet if you see a data log-based ontology that the guy was trained at one of the database schools. And then there's first-order logic. An example there is the common logic. This has recently become an ISO standard. I believe it's ISO 24707. Okay. And there are references to some of these in the end. I'll say more about these in a minute. So the logic-based representations typically give you precise formal semantics, or more likely to have a precise formal semantics written up for them. And they tend to be more expressive than, say, some of the simple graph stuff, particularly if you're using first-order logic. They have issues. They have issues in terms of scalability, in terms of performance. They have, and in particular, first-order logic is not decidable, so you run a query against it, you may go off forever. That's mostly a problem for the first-order logic. The description logic systems, as I said, are typically better behaved, and we're seeing more description logic stuff. And in some cases, what people are doing is they're using description logic to capture a lot of the ontology, and then they're resorting to rules languages such as SWRL or RuleML or one of these other ones to try and get an approximation of first-order logic. That's partly being done for... That's partly being done because people think the rule-oriented languages, rule languages are easier to write than direct first-order logic, and it's partly being done, I think, because a lot of the work happens in the essentially description logic. You can do your taxonomies and partonomies perfectly well in description logic. Did I really just put this here? Okay. So far I've talked about getting these things in, how you represent them, the attraction of actually representing them in, let's say, first-order logic or a graph representation is then you can query this semantically, A, this structured, and B, semantically richer representation in ways like Sparkle that you can't really do against just a text representation. And if you put them into a common representation, which is a challenge in its own right, then it facilitates doing ontology integration because now you can construct mappings between entities in one ontology and entities in another ontology. Usually these entities are concepts. And examples of these mapping relations are same as, is a, and part of. So you can build one ontology might be a finer-grained representation of a particular subject area. So maybe in one ontology you have birds, and another ontology you may have the entire taxonomy for birds. And there's another mapping relation which is near and dear to my heart, as I'm sure Bruce and other folks here know. It shouldn't really be in an ontology because usually in an ontology you don't want to put representational issues like measurement units. But if your ontology is of artifacts like fields and databases or other sorts of things, you will have measurement units and you will have to cope with these things. And this means you need arithmetic or some way of concealing it. And once again, you can represent these mappings using your favorite, I don't know if you can probably do this in UML too. You can do this in frames, you can do this in graphs, and you can do this in logics. And as I said earlier, Cliff Jocelyn has been exploring the graph-based mappings, and I believe prompt is based on logic-based mappings, yes? Okay. Back to partial orders. As I said, I keep harping on the partial orders because this encompasses a large subclass of ontologies. Not everything, but the taxonomies and the partonomies are both partial orders. You want these things to be order preserving. So if A is a subclass of B in one ontology, and you have its image, the mapping from A to A prime and B to B prime in the second ontology, if let's say B is a A in the first ontology, you would like it to be the case that B prime is an A prime in the second ontology. And if you flip that order, then your merged ontology is no longer going to be a partial order. It will just have a cycle in it. And in a taxonomy, for example, that shouldn't happen. So Cliff Jocelyn has been exploring how to represent ontologies as partial orders and what kinds of interesting results you can get from trying to enforce these constraints and how to enforce these constraints. Okay, now, given that you have a partial order, usually when people specify these things, they only specify the transitive reduction. That is, for example, they may say that, a chihuahua is a dog is a mammal. And you won't have is a relationship from chihuahua directly up to mammal. You'll go through dog. That's done for convenience. Well, it's done for two reasons. One is so you have to write less when you're specifying the ontology. It's also for the usual normalization issues so that you don't have to worry about consistency of these things. And the third reason is because the transitive closure can be quite big. So the naive implementation is you just represent chihuahua is a dog is a mammal. And every time you need to test whether a chihuahua is a mammal, you just follow the path up through this tree. And this can be a little bit slow. My impression is that most taxonomies are of order 10 or 15 deep, actually. They're not like hundreds of layers deep or anything like this. People get tired after a while. But, you know, a factor of 10 is still a factor of 10. So sometimes in some systems, for example, I think Jenna does this, they will materialize the transitive closure of the partial order relation, whatever that, or relations, in order to reduce the query times. So they'll put the edge in from chihuahua up to mammal so you can answer those questions faster. Now, the problem is this transitive closure can be quadratic in size, in the number of nodes. So it's big. It takes quite a while to compute initially. And so these sorts of systems tend to be ones in which when you try to load the ontology into whatever store you have and it goes to compute this transitive closure, it can go away for a long time and it can generate a very big file. Nonetheless, once you've done all that, you can answer queries much faster usually. Ontology constraints. So one of the things you want to put into your ontology repository is you want to put various kinds of constraints, and the question is what kind and how do you do this? So once again, pick your favorite representation technology. You can do most of these things. Well, you can do type constraints, range and domain constraints, and certain kinds of cardinality constraints on these things. It's a little harder to specify. So these database integrity constraints. So RDF supports, or RDF schema, and RDF support type constraints. It supports range and domain constraints on relations, binary relations, and some cardinality constraints in OWL, I guess it is. But if you're trying to build ontologies for the purpose of doing databases, or they're coming out of databases, there will typically be all sorts of interesting database integrity constraints. These include functional dependencies, possibly. They include inclusion dependencies, known in the vernacular as foreign key constraints. They include specification that certain relations are invertible. I believe this is in owl also, and disjointedness. So if you say dogs are a dog is a mammal and a cat is a mammal, you may want to be able to say that dogs are not cat. A given animal is never both a dog and a cat. But that's not true if you're doing roles. So if you have persons, a person can be both an employee of a university, they can be a student at that university, they may even be an alumnus of the university. And these are not disjoint completely. Okay. Need for provenance. So this is another one of my hobby horses. Bruce has heard this story before. Ontology, a lot of the times when you listen to people talking about creating ontologies, there is this working hypothesis that the ontologists write the definitions essentially ab initio, or at least they have fairly free rein to do this. And what many ontologists don't seem to recognize, but I think is recognized in the medical community, for example, and is recognized in EPA and various other places, is that most of the definitions in the world are not written by computer scientists. They're written by administrators, for example, a code of federal regulations. They're written by legislators in legislation. They're written by judges in court decisions. And they're written by professional bodies such as the FASB for accounting regulations. And so what this requires is that if you're doing an ontology in, let's say, accounting, you can't just sit there and make all this stuff up. You've got to go check the accounting regulations, or you've got to check the code of federal regulations or whatever. And if you're formally encoding this definition in, let's say, description logic or something, you want to put a citation in that says, where did this come from? And you want to do it for two reasons. So the people who are using it will know that you got it right or got a reasonably authoritative source. And B, because periodically they change these things. Laws get rewritten. We get new court decisions. And when they do that, you need to go in and change your formal ontology if that's what you've built. 3 minutes. I'm on. Okay, I'll speed up. So the implications of this are that we need a provenance system for tracking definitions. Typically, as I said, this requires citations to external documents. We may want to track also the individual decisions and changes that are made to definitions. Part of the problem is that a definition may turn in a formal ontology, a logic-based ontology, a single definition can turn into a collection of axioms. So we need some way of referring to that. And there's some of this stuff in ISO 11179 and XMDR. I'm not sure to what extent it exists in other systems. Other tools. So I think people here are familiar with the repertoire of tools that are used in creating and maintaining ontologies. If you're doing an ontology repository, you want similar sorts of tools. They may be external to the repository system. So you want tools for creating these ontologies. You want tools for editing these ontologies. You want tools for doing differencing, particularly an interesting subject when you're doing graphs. Traditional diff works on text files, but you want something that works on RDF graphs, for example, and there are beginning to be such tools. I don't exactly know how you do differencing on logical representations. Then there are efforts to do ontology modularization tools, such as clustering work that Mala Mehrotra has been doing. You need to be able to export these ontologies. So I've talked about the need to ingest these things, maybe into a common representation. Different people will want them out as either RDF or OWL-DL or OWL or Common Logic or whatever, so you need to be able to export these things. Most people have a hard time dealing with very large files of these ontologies, so you'd like to do ontology visualization. Usually this takes the form of some sort of graph visualization on a partial order. Ontologies undergo evolution, so you need some sort of version management. And for many of these ontologies, you may need some access control. Okay, last couple of slides here. Typically, if you're building an ontology registry, a repository today, it's going to sit somewhere on the internet, or maybe you have a private network if you're a three-letter agency. But in any case, it will typically sit on some sort of network, and you will want to have a service-oriented architecture, which is that you talk to these things on the internet and you get services, such as query services or change of representation services and things like this. And the two most popular ways of doing this are REST and SOAP. REST is representational state transfer. It's built directly on top of HTTP. You have get, put, delete, and post operators. And the, one of the major themes is that you have addresses for every object of any interest. These are URLs or URIs. The alternative is SOAP. SOAP was built on XML remote procedure calls. So it tends to wrap things up. Not everything gets an address. Typically, REST has URI for every object. SOAP tends to have one centralized URI, and then you specify inside the procedure call what exactly you want done. So the attraction of REST is that it's much simpler to implement. It requires some discipline, but basically you need an HTTP server. You need some XML parsers or RDF parsers, as the case may be. You probably need an XML editor or RDF editor or something like this. If you do SOAP, you have a lot more software complexity. However, there's a lot more software tools out there from commercial vendors, all of whom seem to be enamored of SOAP, possibly so because they can sell you complicated software systems to deal with it. And there's some claims been made that it has better security. My advice is use REST. So this bears directly on this question of open ontology repositories. The REST system is just much simpler. REST is the dominant motif in most academic settings, and it's used by, or sometimes bastardized by, Google and various other folks. And lastly, I have a list here that will be up on the web of various ontology repository-related standards. ISO 11179, we have Bruce Bargmeier, and forgetting you, Dan Gilman, who are heavily involved in this. They are currently working on version 3 of part 3, and I believe it's now in committee draft? Yes, it's in committee draft, and where they've been adding ontologies to it. Lisa Kendall has been working on the ontology definition metamodel with OMG. There are topic map standards. Brzezinski, I think, is the name of the fellow doing this. This comes out of, and there are XML topic maps. These are sort of, how would I describe them? Sort of a graph-based representation with sort of somewhat fuzzy semantics. OWL is a W3C standard, as are the RDF recommendations. Common Logic is the now an ISO standard. It's a first-order logic. There's an entire committee of ISO called TC37, which Gail can tell us more about if you have questions. Gail Hodge over here, which works on terminology standards for vocabularies and things like this. There's another W3C standard, the SCOS, which is a simpler representation than some of these. And there's ISO IEC 19763. Did I get the number right, Bruce? Which is the metamodel framework for interoperability, and this is sort of ontology metadata. So to recapitulate, ontology repositories support storage, search, and retrieval of multiple ontologies and ontology integration. The macro level and micro level support and search requirements pose very similar problems, can be addressed with similar technologies. A common ontology representation is desirable, but challenging to do the translation. And multiple ontology representations and ontology integration are the most difficult issues here. My presence here today was paid for by NSF. My previous work was on the XMDR project was paid for by EPA and DOD, and I've been tutored in this by a whole slew of people. And there's my contact information. I finish on time? Reasonable facsimile?
I think, basically, you're still in charge here. We've tried to reserve the discussion time now, particularly in light of, I think, state-of-the-art for repositories and things like that. So
I'm expecting two comments. People who will tell me I got things wrong or I left out their favorite ontology repository. So I'm happy to take those comments because I did obviously didn't cover everything. And then other questions and comments. John.
Okay. Well,
so the speaker is John Soa, and he needs to go find a mic.
One thing that I would like to emphasize is relational databases, because the where clause of every SQL database is full first order logic. And people have been asking questions in SQL for 30 years, and they have not run into any decidability problems. And the important point about decidability is that the question depends entirely on what you're trying to decide. And if what you're trying to do is ask a question, the where clause of an SQL database is, I used to call SQL one of the worst notations for logic ever invented, but that was before I saw some more recent innovations. And so the point is, I say, you've got to integrate SQL databases if you're going to do ontology, because without that, the economy of the whole world runs on SQL. Every commercial database, every commercial website has SQL databases, and you've got to integrate that if you really want to do serious ontology.
Okay. I'm a database person, so I'm reasonably friendly to this idea. I will say that, John, however, that there's a variety of pattern matching things that people sometimes want to do on graphs that are very hard to frame as first order logic. That you can do them, I suspect, but they look miserable, and I suspect they will effectively break most.
No. We do, in our little company, I'm not going to give an advert to it, so I won't mention the company, but we do graph processing, terabytes of graphs, superbly fast, and the thing is that there are graph algorithms that you can do extremely fast with very, very clever techniques. So, you can do graphs very efficiently.
I have a question.
Yes?
Question for John. John, you suggest that I possibly agree, but how? How do you integrate database with ontological models? Quickly, in a sentence, right?
Just in one sentence, I would say use first-order logic. The SQL where clause is first-order logic, and that's a superset of OWL and RDF and all these others. So use first-order logic. Common logic is it.
Yes? Could you identify yourself?
Yeah, I'm Jim Sirachi. I'm with the Health and Human Services. And basically, we do a lot of work in medical informatics, and there's a tremendous interest in ontologies in the field. And I'm new to this arena, so I would like to sort of ask what people's experiences have been in the complexity of mapping one ontology to another, and what the algorithms one might use to do that. So in other words, if you have an ontology of one disease classification, you want to map it to another, are you talking about an exponential process, some sort of partitioned exponential process? What is the rate of growth and complexity in these mapping issues?
I think I'm going to pitch this question to Natasha, because she knows more about this than probably anyone else in the room.
Thank you. So I think there are two issues there. One is the complexity of finding mappings, and one is the complexity of representing them, which are very different issues.
You need to speak into the mic.
Okay, so there are two different issues. One is the complexity of finding mappings themselves and figuring out what the mappings are, and another one is representing them in an ontology repository. And I think they could actually be taken separately in some sense, because, from the point of view of a repository, your issues are how do you represent the mappings, how do you visualize them, how do you reason with them. And that's probably, I mean, that problem is actually also easier to address than the problem of finding the mappings, in particular if you're talking about finding the mappings automatically, which is an AI hard problem. You really can, I mean, it's probably out of our reach for now to try and take two ontologies in, say, the medical domain and try to find the mappings. So what we try to do in the National Center for Biomedical Ontology is try to collect the mappings that are actually there and look at their complexity. And so everyone says that we really do need complex mappings, and, you know, it's not just this is this object from one ontology relationship, object from another ontology, but those are very difficult to create. So the mappings that actually already exist, they're usually one-to-one mappings. That's just the way things are. Again, if you, most people will tell us that they want something much more complex than that, but it's not clear yet, at least to us, how to get those mappings. Again, finding them automatically is a problem. Getting people to sit down and do that is also a problem, because usually everyone is invested in their own ontology. So getting someone invested enough to take to ontology.
My ontology is right.
Of course. But even if... Exactly. So that's also part of the problem.
Well, I think we should say a little bit more, which is typically what the mappings I've seen tend to be linear in the size of the ontologies. As Natasha suggested, they tend to be either one-to-one mappings or some ISA relation. If one ontology is a specialization of another one, you'll get lots of ISA relationships.
Well, I would still call those one-to-one mapping. You're saying this is a something that, something else.
No, it might it might be a subclass of something else.
Well, it's, yeah.
So, but there's a worse problem, okay? And that is, Mark probably knows this number better than me, but if I recall correctly, in systems like SNOMED and these other large medical terminologies, something like half of all the terms are atomic, more than half, which means that you don't have any fancy description logic describing most of the concepts in these things. What you have are base terms that people have defined in terms of natural language, and about all you can do is vocabulary matching out for the definitions or something, and then someone has to eyeball it. So the problem is not the computation time, which for the kinds of things we can do is tractable. The problem is that it takes human time to build these things. And I don't know why it is. I mean, I've always been very surprised to learn how many atomic terms there are in these big medical ontologies. I'm just baffled as to why this is the case.
And in addition to all the time, there's another issue that it's not always non-controversial what the mappings are. So even if we had all the time in the world, it's still, there are many cases, people have done these experiments where it actually, it depends on the application context. So just because there are not that many definitions, sometimes it's actually ambiguous what those concepts are and what the exact mapping should be.
Well, in particular, there are two areas where you have problems. One is a lot of these psychological diseases have either murky characterizations, they have like K out of N symptoms and other strange things in the diagnostic manual. And worse than that, the meaning of schizophrenia differs, as it's commonly used, differs from one country to another, radically. And the other issue is in scientific frontiers, which are still unsettled, you will see different conceptualizations floating around, and people have not just egos, but entire scientific theories committed to ontologies. And until the scientific questions are settled, it's often not clear what the appropriate ontology is. Say your name and question.
Amanda Weisdom. I have a comment on this topic and a question for you. The comment is that in addition to all the stated complexities of mapping, let me also add that mapping is done for many different purposes and different mappings. For example, from a lower granularity ontology to a higher are different for quite different purposes, and organizations make policy decisions about whether to map in certain circumstances or prefer by authority in certain circumstances. So my comment is that I would highly advocate that an ontology repository be designed to capture as much mapping relevant information as possible, but not take on the job of supporting any particular kind of mapping or mapping policy. My question is back to a comment you made at the very beginning of your talk, where you said though some people distinguish repositories and registries, you're going to treat them as interchangeable. And that actually surprised me. So I'm wondering if you would go back and say a little more about that.
Okay. My understanding of the people who distinguish between registries and repositories is that I think that the people who make this distinction usually may argue that registries are essentially indices to these things, and repositories actually have the content of the ontologies. Now, for example, XMDR is Extended Metadata Registry. The ISO 11179 uses the term registry, where we're using repository here. So, but I think, for example, was it EBXML made this distinction between registries and repositories?
Yeah. Is okay.
Well, no, I mean, there are communities that do make this distinction, and it sort of corresponds to this distinction between it's used in the context of federated architectures, where at best you may centralize the metadata for each ontology and some indexing capability so that you have some chance of finding out that, oh, I want a medical ontology. Well, it turns out you'll get SNOMED and UMLS and various other ones, the foundational ontology of anatomy and things like this, and then you say, oh, well, actually, I really need the anatomy one, or I need one of these other ones. And then you'll go off to wherever they keep this thing, and hopefully that server can do something more than supply a FTP file. It maybe can process Sparkle queries or something like this. But I think the primary people making this distinction are the EBXML community. I haven't seen it used extensively. It's certainly not a distinction that the 11179 community uses. I haven't seen it elsewhere. Other people can speak to this.
So would it be fair to simply say that whatever the distinction that might be used in some contexts, here you're talking about repositories and some things that are called registries but serve the same function, and just that other thing with just the metadata isn't on the table.
No,
fair?
No, the registries typically don't have the full ontology.
Yes.
They haven't collected the full ontologies is my understanding of the distinction that's made from people who do make that distinction. The rest of us just treat these terms interchangeably. But there was a point that you made which I think bears some amplification, and that is take, for example, multiple ontologies, each of which has the word wetlands in it. In the EPA, I believe there are 7 different definitions of wetlands depending on which piece of enabling legislation you're referring to or which court decision. So you may need, if you're using this, and they would presumably be, since they're different concepts, they would presumably, you'd have different concepts for them, but they're using the same word, and presumably you need to specify some sort of context, namely with respect to what legislation or what court decision or things like this. And this is a problem I haven't gotten into, but the question of how to do modularization and contextualization of ontologies is with us in spades in the ontology repositories, because they're much more diverse and they're coming at us from many different places. And this generates a number of requirements. One is having some way of dealing with namespaces. And part of the problem is that the XML namespaces are typically, the short versions are discarded, and everything has this giant name, fully qualified name, and this is really unwieldy to deal with. And in some cases, it's difficult to do the inverse mapping on the way out.
Yeah, exactly. A way that we put that sometimes at the in the Air Force interoperability efforts is that we want to maximize semantic interoperability while minimizing integration. We do not want to try and create one big ontology that has all these bits perfectly consistent, nor do we want to force anybody into uniform terminology. So there's this, so this distinction between interoperability and integration becomes important. And my advocacy point, I guess, is that it seems to me that an open ontology repository should have some of the same emphasis. Gather, you know, hold ontologies in a way that supports interoperability, but does not try to attempt or force integration.
Okay, that's all I have to say.
Before, Robbie, I let you go there, I just wanted to invite anyone who's remotely calling in, if I can encourage you to, first of all, log into the chat room, which is the link to which can be found at the bottom of the wiki page for the Ontology Summit, and then you can raise your hand when you're in the chat room by, what is it, pressing 1-1, is that right?
1-1.
Oh, 1-1's on the phone. I see. Okay.
The chat
is where you raise your hand, but then you have to unmute yourself when you're on the phone by pressing 1-1.
Star 3.
I'm screwing this up. Anyway, 1-1 raises your hand on the phone, or press the raise your hand button on the chat room, and press *3 to unmute yourself. Okay. Peter's feeding me all kinds of stuff here. Okay, so while any of you might be doing that, Ravi, why don't you go ahead?
It's more a comment and a seeking guidance from the community. We have spent a lot of time defining objects and their attributes. We haven't spent as much time as a research community worrying about mapping relationships, relationship types, as much as we would like to see. If we can get good handle and some kind of convergence, or in the absence of absolute convergence, at least an agreement for steps to follow in machine interpretability of relationships, then we would make some headway. The triples, the quads, the NARIES, N-A-R-I-E-S, however it's spoken, NARIES, N-A-R-I-E-S, which you described, breaks down into binary relationships in a certain order.
Okay.
So if we can have either metamodels, or we can have a process-based understanding, and I'm thinking, do we really understand how our mind understands things? If we could map part of the neural aspect, part of the process aspect of relationships, and part of the types and classification of relationships, we would probably cross the next hurdle in this area. So I have seen here and there, for example, Peter, your sessions are the ones from Susan that I attend, from Susan Turnbull. In one of these, there was a concept matching between ontologies. So it went to a higher level and matched it as a pattern, which you also referred to, Frank, in your ontology integration or interoperability area. So I would like the community guidance, and especially Frank's opinion, on where the next frontier is in mapping relationships and processes about relationships.
Well, I'm not the person to speak to processes. I assume that we have some people here from NIST manufacturing that have worked on process ontologies. Oh, so the other issue is relationships. And I guess what I would say, well, let me say two things. First of all, there is a reasonably detailed treatment of relationships in the new version of the ISO 11179 Part 3. At least it was there when last I left off, because I spent a year or two trying to carve it into the standard. So relationships are very important. RDF doesn't directly support the NRE relationships. If memory serves correctly, we made relationships a subclass of concept. Was that? Okay, so So, for example, in RDF, the label on an edge is typically a relationship label, and it can refer to an arbitrary URI, and therefore you can build taxonomies of relationship types. So, for example, a classic example are kinship relations. So you can have brother, sister, mother, father. All of these are subtypes of kinship relationships, and you can have relationships of there are kinship relationships which have to do with the flow of genetic information, which you would use genetics research setting, which wouldn't. So you don't really care about the marriages unless they have children in those settings. There are other kinds of relationships. For example, in law and accounting, you have fiduciary relationships, which are agent kinds of relationships where people have financial responsibilities to other people. I think the answer is yes, you want to be able to have the usual kinds of taxonomies of relationships as well as taxonomies of things. And it is not a subject which has gotten as great treatment. In lexical terms, in terms of terminology systems, if you look at these systems, you find that they're completely dominated by nouns, and that they tend not to have nearly as many verbs in them. And the treatment of verbs in ontologies is generally a somewhat neglected subject. But there was a paper on the treatment of verbs in one of the monographs. I can't remember which one. It was either FOIS or another one from IS Press had actually a paper. There has been some work on ontologies of verbs. In addition to just simple linguistic stuff, there's deeper semantics issues in verbs. Yes? I guess we've got 5 more minutes.
Todd Schneider, short question. You had suggested the...
I'm talking.
Can you hear me now? Hello? Is it on? Okay. Todd Schneider, question I had is about your requirement, it seems, for integration capabilities in the repository. I'd like to know why you think that's necessary.
Oh, because the typical use case is that you're culling through these multiple ontologies to assemble either a smaller ontology or a bigger ontology, as the case may be, and you're taking concepts from multiple ontologies to assemble this new ontology. And that means you don't need full integration, but you need to be able to specify some of these mappings. You could envision model, if the two ontologies were disjoint, so we have an aircraft ontology over here and a ship ontology over there, and we're doing integrated warfare, and we want a combined ship and aircraft ontology, then since these are completely disjoint ontologies, you don't need any fancy mappings. They're except maybe up at the top where you say there are both weapons platforms or something like this. But
isn't that work? Wouldn't that work be done outside the repository?
And well, yes,
you put it back in, and which then it suggests you have additional requirements on your provenance, particularly the mapping.
So many of these tools are, for example, the tools that do the ontology alignment are usually external to the repository. But you want to be able to store those mappings in the repository and preserve them.
The mappings or as part of the provenance of the newly created ontology?
Well, often the mappings. But Mark can speak to this.
Well, I just want to amplify what you're saying, Frank, and actually go a bit further. Before this session, I guess last week, Pat Hayes posted a note to the list asking us why we needed ontology repositories in the first place, and aren't we all just wasting our time if we can just put all this stuff up on the web and call it done. And for those of us, certainly those of us at Stanford working on this BioPortal resource, which is an ontology repository of over 1,000 ontologies used in biomedicine, the answer is yes, you can put it on the web and you're done. But you haven't really achieved the value that users really want by using mappings and other kinds of metadata to facilitate integration and interoperation among the ontologies. So, for example, earlier there was some discussion about why mappings might be so hard. And even in medicine, when you're talking about something as very straightforward as anatomy, you would think that mapping between mouse anatomy and rat anatomy would be pretty straightforward. Turns out it's not, and there's lots of argument within the communities, as Olivia Bodenreiter has pointed out, about how to bring these various ontologies together, and it's the mappings that actually provide the value added. So you'll see the demo of BioPortal tonight when Benjamin does that, but I think in BioPortal for sure, where we're trying to claim we have value added is not actually the repository function as much as the mapping function and the other kinds of metadata that are associated with ontologies. So because I really believe why we're here is not just to create a collection of resources, but to create the technology that links them together so that people can actually get more than just the collection.
I'd like to make a comment that in general, the set of mappings will not be linear. So that point was made earlier. In fact, in general, it'll require an integrative ontology to map two ontologies. That's at a more complex level. Now, we can hopefully make do for certain purposes without that precision, if you will. But the idea is that over time, of course, domain ontologies will have to be map to things that are at least as expressive as either one, and in fact introduce new content, new structure. So ultimately it may be that they are linked to emerging middles and upper ontologies.
I don't know your name.
Mark Wine.
Practically we're starting to see emerge, as Mark and your folks are at least aware and some involved, projects that will be in the health grid space, for example, in rural northeast Colorado, developing a socially relevant knowledge base for telemedicine, which actually will be collaborative diagnostics, or open source research environment across cardiology, surgery, breast care, oncology at Walter Reed Medical Center that will be, in the end, hopefully, a large ubiquitous research data and functionality sharing environment and others. How can we practically make available ontologies, repositories, and the mapping, which we're seeing now in these emerging, in the end, health grid kinds of projects, and biosurveillance is a leading area where the ontologies and semantics are coming in strongly in R&D and telemedicine and informatics.
Well, I guess I would say from the perspective of the work we're doing at Stanford, bring us your ontologies yearning to breathe free. We are chartered as a National Center for Biomedical Ontology to create the definitive repository for biomedical ontologies, and BioPortal represents the resource that our particular National Center for Biomedical Computing is developing precisely for accessing ontologies, for mappings, for metadata, for all the things that we think will make ontologies useful. So the answer is we should definitely talk about this offline. But we are in a position now where we are looking forward to people submitting ontologies to us, not only so that we can present them to the rest of the world for the purpose of reuse, but also so that motivated folks can map them to other ontologies and can add the appropriate metadata that will make them more useful by people who really want to figure out what a biosurveillance ontology might be good for.
And let me just add to what Mark said. So in addition to ontologies, what we will show tonight in the demo, we already do accept mappings as well, and we have several thousand mappings there between the ontologies and BioPortal. And so our approach is, you know, we can take a bulk of mappings that you created with some tool outside, or you can go in and create kind of point-to-point mappings in the BioPortal. We don't expect anyone to do this with hundreds of mappings, but, you know, if there is an occasional thing that you see that is missing. And we're preserving all the provenance. And at this point, we're taking this very open approach with an open repository, is that mappings, you know, if someone mapped A to B, it doesn't mean that you cannot say, no, it maps to something else. And we're actually looking now at the contradictory mappings that we're getting, or mappings that are different between the term in one ontology. Someone mapped it to one term in another ontology, and someone mapped it to something else, and we're looking at... basically, at this point, we're storing it. We're not precluding you from doing it in any way.
So let me give...
Portal.
Yeah. For the alpha.biontology.org, right?
So let me just give an example of where it would generate different kinds of mappings, and that is suppose you have an ontology of chemical compounds, and this is a very fine-grained ontology, so let's say it has chirality information in it. You then may want to have a coarser-grained ontology which divides these things into equivalence classes without respect to chirality, because chirality is important for biological activity, but you can't distinguish it, for example, in mass spectrometry, as far as I know. And so you could envision different kinds of ontologies on chemical compounds that had to do with whether or not these compounds are distinguishable by different kinds of instrumentation. I don't know what's going on here. But anyway, so the point being that all of these things would be chemical ontologies, but depending on the purpose you have, you may want different chemical ontologies. Anyway, Joanne.
Hi, I just have two of the experiences I've been involved in can maybe offer shedding some light. So one, the BioPax initiative was initiative to bring together different types of biological pathway data, so signaling pathways, metabolic pathways, gene regulatory pathways, and interaction networks. And what we did, we had to do quite a bit of mapping from lots of different data sets. And in effect, in retrospect, what we realized we did was we created an upper-level ontology for biological pathways, made more abstract classes that these could then be mapped to. So that's one example. Another is I'm involved with creating an application ontology, which maps out to a lot of different ontologies for influenza. And there I had to map several different vocabularies from clinical, geospatial, environmental, habitat data, surveillance data, isolates, sequencing, all those kind of things. And there the approach that we used was to start with sort of creating a separate vocabulary that was basically the concepts they were mapping, and then mapping all of these to the concepts and focusing on the definitions, because people tend to be more inclined to agree about definitions and less inclined to give up their precious vocabulary terms. So those are just two quick comments.
Yes, I don't know your name.
My name is Alex. I just wanted to say that I have found very useful the facilities provided by the BioPortal in what has to do with mapping, particularly when it comes to mapping based on the community. I mean, you leave the mapping in the hands of the community, and this is particularly important in the biomedical domain, because the example that you gave us just recently about an ontology for chemical compounds, if you take a look at the ontology for chemical compounds that is available at the BioPortal, you will see that mapping these with chemical compounds that are of critical importance in the medical community, like lipids, is not something that you can just do by downloading both ontologies and giving them to a domain expert. That requires a lot more. And the mapping, the information that comes along with the mapping that is being done by the community has been for me very, very useful, particularly when modeling diseases like dengue, that brings together a lot of different social aspects. My other comment has to do with I would like to have a repository, but I wouldn't just like to have a CVS, a simple FTP site where I could just download ontologies, because for that matter, I could just Google things, or I could Google, and that would give me exactly the same capabilities. What I would like to see is something that gives me a lot of different tools to bring together different ontologies. When one is developing an ontology, usually one starts by having some sort of row baseline ontology, then you use different services like the ontology lookup service just to find as to whether or not the particular term you're working with has already been reported in other existing ontologies, and then you move into object properties, for instance, and all that sort of things. And this is something that falls in the heels of an integrated development environment for ontologies, something like BioPortal or like Prodigy.
Or like what?
So let me simply comment that one of the reasons for building ontology repositories or more generally these metadata registries is that if you can record the existing usage and ontologies, then hopefully it will be easier for people developing new applications or new ontologies to actually reuse existing work rather than creating completely de novo ontologies, which are unlikely to match up to the existing ones. And this is the driving force behind the data dictionaries and the metadata registries and these ontology and schema registries and all these things. One of the problems we have had, particularly, for example, in database schemas, is that people don't post these things to the web, and they don't annotate them with definitions and so on. Or the definitions they supply are completely inadequate. So, for example, you'll see there must be a zillion forms in which they ask for mother's name. And they usually think this is self-evident, but motherhood is now half a dozen different social and biological roles, including genetic motherhood, gestational motherhood, legal roles such as guardian or all sorts of things. The point is, in a hospital setting, you may want to know who a child's legal guardian is, or if you're doing genetic research, you may need to know who their genetic mother is, which may be different than their gestational mother and other sorts of things like this. And in short order, people are going to have 23 mothers for different chromosomes.
One last comment on the subject for me. I want to say first that I vehemently agree with the comments that a lot of the value added comes from the support for mapping and integration and so forth. And I really liked what Natasha was saying about providing the support for mapping and the capability to allow users to map in different ways and retain that. I don't want to diminish the importance of having an open ontology repository support mapping. I want to make one more stab at emphasizing the desirability of keeping it modular so that it supports many.
We're going to have to wrap this up in short order here. Let me make one comment and then John again. Particularly in scientific ontologies, I think that it is critical that all sorts of measured attributes carry with them annotations as to their dimensionality, which is the more semantic term for the generalization of measurement units. And this is a subject which I guess Tom Gruber has worked on. It's a subject which I think Elisa Kendall has worked on. Evan Wallace has been working on this here at NIST. And yet it is a subject particularly in databases, but also in ontologies, which tends not to be adequately addressed in many cases, and it's ones that desperately cries out for standardization. John, you had a comment.
Okay. I just wanted to second the point about modularity and interoperability without integration. I think that is an extremely important issue, and I'd like to emphasize the point that when we have people interoperating or our current systems interoperating, it's always on a task-oriented basis, that you never have a global ontology of all the people in this room. That would be impossible. But what we can all talk about ontology in this room, then we can go to another room and talk about cooking or something else with a totally different set of people and have interoperability on that basis. So I think we should put on the agenda the slogan. I love that slogan, interoperability without integration and the importance of task-oriented interoperability. I think that's very important to have as a top-level item.
Okay. One last question.
Thank you. This is Lee from RPI. Actually, I was, besides the mapping issues, I also noticed another issue just from what you just said. It's just like we are actually, in my past experience, we are not just indexing ontologies. We are also indexing the usage of ontology. And therefore, based on the usage of ontology, we can guide the reuse of ontology. How do you think about that?
I'm not quite sure what you're saying, but let me try to frame it in terms that I do recognize, which is if the purpose of your ontology is to construct a standardized nomenclature, that is a controlled vocabulary, often you'll want to carry around linguistic or lexical attributes which you may not have in a sort of general purpose ontology. And similarly, if your goal is to design databases, you'll want mappings between concepts in the ontology or relationships in the ontology and artifacts of your database schemas. So, and we see, for example, in 1.11.79, which I think was originally designed to support database work and applications, that there are specialized constructions intended to support this mapping into schemas. Okay, so we're going to stop, and we're supposed to reconvene here at 11 a.m., at which point, what happens?
Michelle will take us away on architectures.
Okay.
So we got the next track. Stretch that 5 minutes. Okay, 11:05 we'll give you. It's your time, so.